Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
The media has controlled the propaganda that's been cast upon the people, where the people are convinced that this is the right way to go because they don't actually take the time to critically think about what they're being told or look at the data behind it. I mean, the data you're showing is clear. It's national suicide.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Dr. Chris Martinson, and I'm back again with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Good, Chris. I'm doing good. Good to see you again.
Well, I'm smiling because, you know, just before I hit the record button, we were laughing about deja vu. There's a lot of deja vu going on in these markets because, you know, these markets are in what everybody is now classifying as bubble territory. Right? By
yes.
All these valuation measures, price to this, you know, ratios to that. And yet they power on. And so, you know, where is all this money coming from and what's powering all of this? And we saw gold and silver beginning to stay something, you know, Bitcoin's been saying something, but so is the stock price of NVIDIA, all that. So I think we have to start with gold and silver because that was pretty exciting. What's been going on the last 48 hours?
Oh, yeah. I mean, holy cow, Chris. Like, I heard somebody quote this the other day. It's like, you know, this massive gold correction has been the worst that we've ever seen. It seems like forever since I've seen this price. And it was, you know, feels like it was a week ago, October 13th.
It was a week ago. So this is the great smash we're talking about here right now. At the time I took this, gold was at, on the futures market, 4,052. Which is down pretty considerably. It tagged 4,400. So let's call that a 10% decline in just a day and a half here, because today is not over. But that brings us back to where it was a week ago, more or less. Obviously, it was on a big run. We saw the same thing for silver, right? Again, a big run up here, and then this coming back. Now, I want to talk about the silver a little bit because it's instructive. So we've talked about this before, Paul, where These things called the futures market, it's just their paper promises, right, to trade anything at all, corn, soybeans, the S&P 500, oil, or silver and gold, that those markets have become so large by design that they actually move, they are the signal in this story. So, mm-hmm. I want to talk about this, though, from a physical standpoint, because that's what we were talking about last week, was that in the last few weeks, is that it looks like there's a physical problem in the silver market in particular. And if that gets exposed, boy, it could unravel a lot of threads in this carpet, and nobody has any interest in that. So I think you and I had speculated that the bullion banks, are going to do everything in their power to get this back under control. I think that's what it looks like right there, is like they're just like banging on this.
Right? It appears that way, right on cue too.
Get this, though. So I talked about the overnight. So 4 o'clock in the morning, Eastern Daylight Time, banksters dropped a huge payload. 42,350,000 ounces of silver dropped in paper terms into the market in just 15 minutes. So can the market absorb 42 million ounces in 15 minutes at 4 in the morning? No, obviously
Goodness
not.
Gracious. That's amazing that it held up better than it did with that type of selling liquidation
in
15 minutes in a thin market. Wow.
Mm-hmm. That's how they operate. They go into the thinnest part of the market and do these bid crushing just dumps, just huge dumps. I think it smells a little desperate. Okay. Mm-hmm. And here's why. To get there, let's take a quick tour, some silver context. So there's going to be about 820 million ounces mined this year. This is new mine supply from mines. Most of this is actually already spoken for. Most of these mines actually have deals with, like, you know, Chinese smelters and all of that. So, but let's just imagine there's 820 million ounces to be mined this year. Divide by 52 weeks. First divide by 32,150, which is how many ounces, troy ounces in a ton, T-O-N-N-E-S, a metric ton. So there's going to be 25,500 metric tons. Now we divide that by 52 weeks. It's 490 tons a week. That's what we get to work with. There's 490 tons available on an average basis, which can go hither and yon. And just a quick rule of thumb is 1 million troy ounces is about 31 tons. Okay. So check this out. This comes to us from October 22nd, which is this morning out of Shanghai. And I want you to notice that last week there was 1.1 million kilograms. And today there's 691,416 tons left the Shanghai Silver Exchange in 1 week.
Wow.
Basically, almost 100% of world mine output, close, left in a week from just the Shanghai Exchange.
Just the Shanghai Exchange. That's incredible.
Yep. It's just flooding out of there. Let's look at Bob the Bullionaire, who I just discovered recently and I've become a big fan of. He says, wow, another day, another massive depletion of COMEX. Actual physical silver, 2.6 million ounces gone. So 2.6 million ounces, that's another 80 tons. That's in 1 day. 1 day. So now we have 100% of world mine output just left, right? For this in a day, right? And then, uh-oh, maybe this was going to cause some of the trouble here, was that India is going to allow silver and gold to be used as collateral for bank loans. So they've basically remonetized gold and silver.
Wow.
I don't think I could go down to my bank and say, hey, I got some silver. I would like to collateralize a loan. They would be like, what's silver?
They would call the local psychiatrist and have them come down and talk to you if you did that local bank, Chris.
Definitely a suspicious activity report would get filed. Yeah. I'd be get sarred up there. All right, almost done. So I think this is part of the pressure. Like, this is part of the panic because now India, we haven't talked about India's just vacuuming silver out as far as it can. So Bob the Bullionaire, carrying on, says, my recent theory on COMEX is that they are now being used as the vault of last resort because the LBMA in London broke on or about the 3rd of October. You can see it in the COMEX data. I matched it with the timing by others, Jensen and others. The LBMA free float went code red. It's all gone. They have no silver left. They had nothing. There were rumors of planes flying it into London. And the vault of last resort just lost 9.4% of its free float in 10 days. So you were losing about, we don't have that much left if we're losing 10% in 10 days. Won't be long until COMEX silver free float is also zero. Oh, in these futures, Paul, that we talked about when they sold those, 42 million ounces of silver, that's paper silver, but it's paper silver that has a contractual potential for delivery, and the delivery month would have been December. And he said, and we have December deliveries looming, and my model shows 110 million ounces, which is insane. And a good amount of those ounces will be gone from free float forever. I don't think that'll all get delivered. But just to be clear, that would be 3,421 tons to get delivered out. 13% of global mine output just would evaporate from COMEX. And so the story we're working on here now is that, yes, they've dumped a lot of paper, but those are promises. And a lot of people are now squinting, kind of puzzling at December, saying, what are they going to do if India and China just stand for delivery, or anybody stands for delivery and they don't have it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then what?
I would assume that's going to be another squeeze by, lack of inventory for demand, right? I mean, that's going to blow those contracts up. That's a lot of money to lose on that side.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a very stressed, very thin. Silver's a tiny market. I mean, Elon could buy 100% of the existing silver in the world right now if he wanted to. It's tiny. But what we saw in these past couple of weeks is that the refineries all got backed up because people were bringing in grandma's silverware and all that stuff. So they didn't need any more of that 0.925 sterling silver because they have to refine it. Because what they needed were these 1,000-ounce, good for delivery, 0.999 fine bars.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't take any more of that junk silver. So last week we saw huge stresses in the market with premiums blowing out on coins and things like that, and actual junk silver trading for below spot because it's all clogged up. I haven't seen this level of disruption since the 2009 silver slam that we had. Same thing, saw the same dynamics back then. What it just says is we have a very thin market, and it's in a lot of distress. But this time, we didn't have this in 2009.
No.
We didn't have this in 2009.
No. And going back to that 10 to 1, Chris, just to point out, help me understand this if I'm incorrect. So India Unleashes Silver is a banking collateral with 10 to 1 gold to silver ratio. So if gold's $4,000 an ounce, that's saying that that can be collateral at a value of $400 per ounce for silver. Am I getting that correctly?
I'm not sure. I think the way I'm reading this is they said, hey, we'll take up to a kilo of gold, which would be 30 ounces times $100,000-ish. And silver, you could collateralize a loan with up to 10 kilos of silver, I guess. I don't know, but it says creating an industry-shaking 10-to-1 monetary metal bench. I don't know how to interpret that.
I mean, that's pretty interesting if that's the case. So, I mean, if gold is 10 times silver, silver's $4,000 an ounce, or $400 an ounce at 4,000. So that's pretty interesting. That expands their money supply at that ratio right there, does it not? I mean, I know it's linked to the metal, but with the current market price of around, I didn't look at it today, you know, 45 to 50, then there's a lot of upside potential in silver there based on what the government's allowing their banking system to do in India. That's interesting to me.
Let's look at this real quick then. So this just came out on October 22nd, just this morning. So this is in Business Standard, which is mostly looks at foreign, non-U.S. Kind of stuff. So it says here, sold out in India, panic in London. What triggered the silver market chaos? They're trying to understand this. And they said, okay, so Indian demand is soaring. China closed for a week-long holiday. So the bullion dealers, they went to London. They said, hey, we need some for their, they had big festivals in India. And they discovered that London was out. They were just largely sold out, like they're gone. And so they said, oh, well, you know, since the start of 2025, ETF investors have hoovered up more than 100 million ounces of silver. So around 2 weeks ago, look at this, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, the largest precious metal dealer and an important bullion supplier to the Indian market, told at least one of its clients that it had no more silver available to deliver to India for the month of October, and the soonest it could get supplies was November. So we're supposed to believe now, Paul, that silver's on sale. Look at all this silver. Who wants it? They're just throwing it out the window. But you just can't have any.
Yeah.
Right? This just shows what a broken situation we have right now.
It really is. But I mean, obviously the powers that be are, for whatever reason, are allowing these shenanigans to continue with the risk of failed delivery, which is going to further exacerbate the supply squeeze right now.
Yeah. And by the way, I almost spit JP Morgan out because I'm really annoyed with them, and I'm annoyed with our system, because listen, I believe in a well-regulated market. You and I both live within a regulatory environment. I believe that if anybody is caught being a scoundrel in our business, good, have night-tight regulators and get them out of the business real quick. The reason I'm annoyed is that JP Morgan has already been convicted, right? And had two people, Michael Nowak and Greg Smith, went to prison for rigging the gold and silver markets, right? JP Morgan Chase, involved in a silver trading scandal, came to light in 2020. Though the misconduct occurred over nearly a decade. So they threw these two schlubs in jail, but I'm going to bet they had superiors who knew all about this since it went on for a decade, right? And they used an illegal form of market manipulation. The precious metals markets is called spoofing. That's where you put in a bunch of fake orders to create this appearance that there's like millions of ounces suddenly for sale, and oh my gosh, and it scares everybody. And then anyway, so they were, Paul, if you or I did this, we would lose our licenses and we'd be gone, and rightly so, in a skinny minute, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We would not have the ability to continue those trading operations if we were allowed to stay in the business, if that was the case. So why did they allow them to continue without unbelievably increased regulatory disclosures and monitoring?
They're still in the business, and they're still out there doing what they do. No change, right? So good news, I guess, is that what it does is so, you know, we've talked about this idea that silver is this beach ball that's been held underwater. But I want to add to that by saying, yep, that's true. And that beach ball is expanding while it's down there.
With a little helium being added to it as well.
Yeah, helium. It's getting pumped. No, it is. It's because the longer they continue this rigging game, the more explosive it gets. So now this is how I interpret them panic dumping tens, if not now hundreds of millions of ounces of silver into these little thin markets. So I think each day this week so far, it's been closing in on 1 billion ounces of paper silver traded every day.
Right? Wow.
That doesn't mean 1 billion dumped in there because people are buying, selling, trying to get in, trying to get out. But we'll have to see how the open interest settles out at the end of the week. But they've been really ramping it up, like pushing hard, just desperately trying to get people to panic out of their silver and or gold. And this is the oldest game in the book. But I think they're out with watching Shanghai vacuuming out 400 tons in a week. Lord only knows what India's pulling into its whatever it can. I don't know. I think we're at the end of this game.
Well, I mean, from that standpoint, if we're right that it's a 10-to-1 linking with gold versus silver, why in the world would an Indian bank not buy up every bit of the silver that they could possibly buy up right now? Because you're getting it for pennies on the, what is the ratio now?
It's 80-to-1.
80-to-1. So, I mean, that's an unbelievable arbitrage from a long-term standpoint for an Indian bank. That's incredible.
Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. So let's talk about some theories for why this slam had to happen. VBL's ghost at Asorin the K on Twitter, which is Vince Lancey, wrote here, quote, 1 billion Indians and 1 billion Chinese will soon be able to collateralize their gold and silver to improve their personal living conditions. The unlocking of the financial buying power of precious metals will be the single biggest boost to standard of living of the global South since the dollar standard was adopted in 1971. Those two nations know this, and that's why their governments have been hoarding it, as they are front-running the unlocking of the buying power at the grassroots level, which is coming. Without selling a single dollar, they will replace U.S. treasuries in the marketplace as high-quality collateral. The death of the dollar is coming from the ground up, not by decree. Gold is money, but silver is more. So he's suggesting that the great game is afoot. China and India have sort of observed that the dollar's not what it used to be and would rather have something else as collateral. So culturally, traditionally, obviously, they have a very different relationship to gold and silver than we do here in the U.S. and Europe.
Well, they're not as blindly trusting of their government as what our citizenry is as well. They've been through, you know, the history and the remembrance of fiat currency failure and lack of trust. So it makes sense.
But we've been sort of poking around the edges, like what really is Trump and Bessent? What are they up to? Right.
Right.
Taking interest in companies, tariffs, kind of strong arming. And there was that idea of the Mar-a-Lago Accords, which was basically, look, we're going to let the dollar get a little weaker, and we want to go into these stable coins as a way of sort of like enshrining treasuries as the backing for the world. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to back the world with dollars anymore. We're going to back it with treasuries, which is like, which is an IOU.
Yes.
Right. And so they're working extra hard to try and get that underway. And then everything we see with that move by India, I think that was a sharp poke right in the eye of that idea. It's like, oh, you're going to do that? We're going to allow people to collateralize gold and silver. And then China opens up a yuan for gold swap exchange, two locations, Hong Kong and Saudi Arabia. So you can feel that's the great game. Like, mm-hmm. what's going to be the currency and what do we do vis-a-vis the dollar? And a lot of the world is saying, well, by numerical standards, by like just people numbers are saying, we don't want to play that game anymore. I think that's right. What's unfolding here.
I think so as well. And it's going to take some time to continue to unfold, and it's going to continue to gain steam until the point where it's slowly and then all at once, where the market realizes or can't deny it or they can't lie about it anymore. Mm-hmm. But we've continued to accelerate at that pace. And we still have the unit in the background with their discussions and plan to ring, you know, link it to 40% gold. Plus your other commodities, that's not even rolled out yet. Imagine the demand that's going to create on the other side. So it's wise on their part to let the U.S. run whatever game or whoever out there run the game to suppress the price and accumulate it as much as you can over time. Because where a lot of your U.S. investors and speculators are thinking 3, 6, and 9 months from now, these global governments are thinking 3, 5, and 10 years from now. And they've been doing that for quite some time, which is why they've been accumulating it. We're just starting to see the fruit of the seeds that have been laid in the past.
Well, right now, I will tell you that silver is still very tight in the retail market. It's still very tight. Physical silver, right? This is all paper stuff. And, of course, there'll be headlines written on CNBC and MarketWatch reporting with glee, you know, PR for J.P. Morgan et al., that, you know, silver, gold, worst performance ever, but it's paper silver, paper gold. So where are we in terms of physical silver? Mark it down. I'm going to be watching the December deliveries like a hawk, because that's when the firework, all this stuff they just sold, we'll see how much they have to deliver then. And if they can't, that's it. Mm-hmm. We're over. But we've already London has already fumbled this football and has passed. That ball has now been picked up, and Shanghai, I think, is now a more believable gold and silver market than London at this mm-hmm. point.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're having to build trust on a global scale where London is operating off of the trust that others had developed in time, and they don't seem to be trustworthy based on what we're seeing in comparison between one versus the other.
No, they've squandered that. But I mean, they broke that with the nickel market and the LME scandal, right, and all that. So, mm-hmm. but capital goes where it's treated best. But also, you know, you mentioned the most important word, which is trust. If you trust that a contract is a contract, so you and I sell futures contracts for silver, but when the time comes to deliver it, it gets delivered. You don't just at some arbitrary point go, oh, we're going to have to break that contract because it's inconvenient for us right now. To me, JP Morgan telling India, we can't catch any till November, but they're busy selling millions and millions of ounces out of their futures accounts. That's a breach of trust as far as I'm concerned.
It is a breach of trust. And let's say they didn't have it, but they're selling those to drive the prices down so that they can try to shake some loose and accumulate it. Well, that's pure market manipulation. And that's what the authorities are supposed to be, you know, monitoring and keeping from happening, but they seem to ignore it heavily when it comes to the metals market.
Sure is fascinating, though. I'm going to keep my eye on this. And once again to Vince Lancey, he says, geopolitical comment, paper smash with a purpose. Quote, it seems fairly clear, at least to my conspiratorial mind, that given the major geopolitical developments unfolding behind the scenes, and the ongoing physical stress in the silver market, this looks like a deliberate paper-driven sell-off with a purpose. As discussed earlier this morning, the Deutsche Bank report appears to serve as confirmation for the emerging gold is better than the USD narrative, which seems to have gotten hold of some media outlets. That narrative cannot be allowed to stand unchecked, as Trump dissent understand. It looks as if somebody called in the PPT as the plunge protection team to stabilize things, at least temporarily. Trump cannot afford this dynamic to play out with the Xi meeting approaching. the sleeping paper giant has been awakened. So that's an hypothesis there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, gold is a geopolitical asset. It's not this barbarous relic. It's not this shiny pet rock, all that stuff that they denigrate in the West. It is clearly a competitor for U.S. dollar. And it's, as we showed last time on this program, it's clearly catching up with the dollar in terms of international reserve percentages. And it's clear that China and India and the rest of the world, Vietnam, they're not going to get shaken out of their fascination, attraction to gold easily.
No. And it appears, and I would assume with all the lines that you had showed last week, I think it was, where they're with their demand, they're going to have the same lines this week because they're focused on buying the dip in the metals. Where in the U.S., you get more concern with retail investor about, oh, is it time to sell? Should I sell? Right. Like, at least for me, I've not had a whole lot of emails asking if they should buy the dip. We can talk about that a little bit later. But, I mean, there's a subset of retail that's chasing NVIDIA. If it drops, 2%, they're near panic themselves to leverage themselves to buy that. Exact opposite in the U.S. versus what's taking place internationally. So I think there's still a tremendous amount of demand. I'm excited that we've got a chance for it to consolidate to prepare for its next move or go down a little bit more. For those who need the insurance from a long-term standpoint, it gives them a better chance to average into it. So, this is something I believe that's worth taking advantage of if you're patient and looking long-term. And with the potential that next month things could start unraveling again.
Yeah. Well, I'll be completely honest about this, Paul. I don't trade gold or silver. I accumulate. But it's just a way of preserving purchasing power is really all it is. And so it's not a way to get rich quick. You know, NVIDIA has a different fascination, right? For me, gold and silver is very simply. So people, like I said, I had to say this explicitly on Twitter because I bought some silver on Friday and I said, oh, hey, let me correct myself. I didn't buy silver. I traded this form of money for a different form of money. And so if we just go back, say, 5 years, we say, how much would this form of money, my U.S. dollars, what happened to it from 2020 to now? Well, it lost, according to the CPI calculations, 23% of its purchasing power. But if I bought silver, traded that form of money for this form of money, silver, if I held silver from then, what happened to that? Well, it went up about 180% in bad money terms. So in monetary speak, this is called Gresham's Law. Bad money drives out good. Bad money is money that loses 20% of its value in 5 years. Good money is money that maintains its purchasing power. So the bad money drives out good, means there's lots of this floating around, but this becomes scarce. And eventually, as they say, silver becomes unobtainium.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get it.
You've been saying that for several years, and I love that unobtainium term.
Yeah.
Silver.
Well, I got that from Mike Maloney, and who, anyway, it's just, but no, it's coming. I mean, I'm going to take an contrarian view, but that's me. I'm contrarian about everything. This paper smash reeks of panic to me. It's unsubtle. It's in your face. It's designed to show we still have the power over all of this. But meanwhile, the rest of the world's just keep backing up the trucks and just taking the silver away. And I think this is very short-sighted. And I think we're going to wake up one day and go, wow, you should never let paper dominate physical in anything. Copper, oil, corn, silver, I don't care.
Especially when it comes to commodities. And I know that's a general commodity, but something that takes time to pull out of the ground and mine. You can't let it overwhelm. You're distorting the market. It's a different thing when you get into stocks and other, which I kind of disagree with that as well. But yeah, it should be a balanced market.
Well, it should. So let's carry that on, because I want to use copper as a cautionary tale here for this paper over physical idea and as a metaphor for any other commodity we might be talking about right now. So October 20th, Gold Telegraph reporting that Robert Friedland, who's a big-time copper analyst, knows more about it than anybody as far as I'm concerned. Robert Friedland was warning that over the next 18 years, humanity will need to mine as much copper as it has over the last 10,000 years combined.
Wow.
Read that again. Over the next 18 years, humanity is going to need to mine as much copper as it has over the past 10,000 years combined. Okay? And we combine that with this idea. Look at the number of copper discoveries per year. 15 in 1995, 11 in 96, 17, 12, da-da-da. Look at the past, these 10-year period here. 43010101001. Right?
That's incredible.
This is what it's going to look like in graphical terms. This is how much total copper produced over the course of all human history is 700 million tons. By 2050, to do this net zero thing, we're going to need to mine 1.4 billion tons. Twice as much? Wait a minute. We're not finding any, but we need more. We're not finding any, but we need more. And you know why? Look harder. I'll tell you why. Because copper is still, you know, roughly speaking this morning, about $5 a pound. And all these analysts, Robert Friedland says, look, if you want people to be incentivized to go out and open new mines, because they're harder to find. We found the easy stuff. The new stuff is deeper down. It's more dilute. If you want to incentivize them, copper has to be at least twice as expensive as it is today, but three times if we want to really be serious about it, and probably four or five times if we want to meet those goals to do all this, you know, windmills and solar panels and other things, right? But it can't get there. Every time paper, you know, copper starts to move up in price, paper sellers come and just dump it, and here we are. So I think it's a cautionary tale, because the reason we're in this pickle right here, mm-hmm. because from 2013 to 2023, the price of copper went nowhere. Mm-hmm. It was the exact same price. So think of anything, any business, Paul. Can you imagine if you said to Ford, hey, you're going to have to sell your cars for exactly the same today as you sold them for in 2013. We don't care if your wages went up. We don't care if the cost of steel went up. We don't care about any of that. You're going to have to sell them for the same price as today because there's a paper Ford futures market. And Right. There's people selling paper cars by the boatload, as many as you need to keep the price down.
Yeah, and then they're going to say, and oh, by the way, we're going to eventually cause inflation to get to the point with your cost of input going up that you're going to have to work for free. So you might as well convert to a nonprofit at this point. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The manipulation of the market always breaks. Lies always come out in the end. It may take longer than anybody has patience for them to see them, but it's always going to come out. That manipulation will, because the supply and demand metrics that a free market is supposed to deliver are going to be manipulated to the point that all of a sudden it breaks, and then, you know, you're in a much worse situation than what you were before.
How did Ayn Rand put it? You know, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
That's exactly right.
So that's what I think we're going to find out, is that we had this grotesque financialization. It began under Alan Greenspan, and then it was continued under all the subsequent Federal Reserve chair peoples. And everything was financialization. And then I woke up a couple days ago and I read this headline that said, there are more private equity firms than there are McDonald's franchises in the United States right now.
That's amazing. More private equity firms. But it doesn't surprise me because they're outside of a lot of the regulatory burdens in that dark pool of money. Wow. Yeah.
So it's all financialization. So it's like, oh, but Chris, you know, you can, you know, the markets are never wrong. I'm like, no, the markets can be wrong if you allow, if your regulators fail to, like, you have these regulators supposed to regulate markets. First off, they're not supposed to allow overt price manipulation, which is what dumping 42 million ounces at 4 a.m. is. That's not price discovery. That's attempting to set a new price, right? That's right. All it is. Okay, that's obvious. But they have, I fear, Paul, like zero experience. Like it would be good to have somebody regulating the copper market who was a copper miner, or at least some experience in what's actually involved, and go, you know, maybe we shouldn't allow the paper futures market to be more than 20% of the market. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be more than 30%. But when it becomes 99% of the market, it sets the price. And next thing you know, you wake up 10 years later going, wow, we're really short on copper, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it may get a reprieve for a period of time if new construction slows down due to a recession or whatever, but that demand's not backing down. And it may not even back down with all of the money being spent on these data centers and and the infrastructure going into bringing manufacturing back, there's going to be a tremendous demand for that copper.
Well, there is. It's just, it's an easy setup. I mean, this is going to blow up on us at some point, and that'll be that. And but I have another cautionary tale here for this is going to focus on our European listeners here, but I think it's cautionary tale for Canadians and Australians, but then eventually United States as well. And it's this. The Financial Times, Paul, came out and said the quiet part out loud. They talked about how Friedrich Merz is testing Germany's patience, but here's a nice summary by the Islander. And it says, quote, steel plants are closing, car factories are shrinking, business leaders are openly furious. The so-called sick man of Europe, Germany, is sick again. But this time the disease isn't inefficiency, it's economic suicide, engineered by unelected EU elites and enforced by the obedient puppets like Friedrich Merz. Merz wants 500 billion euros to rescue industry. But from what? From policies his party endorsed. German output is crashing, energy prices are unlivable, bureaucratic strangulation kills investment. And while Merz beats the drum for a forever war in Ukraine, what was Berlin's lifeline? Nord Stream. Blown up. Sabotaged with a shrug while Brussels and NATO pleaded the fifth. The U.S. may have benefited, but the executioner stood in Brussels. Ursula von der Leyen and the Eurocrat cast led the charge, deindustrialized Germany, sanctioned Moscow, send tanks to Ukraine while the German worker foots the bill. But for what? Kiev was always going to lose. Yet EU elites demand more tribute, more weapons, more factories, and shut, and more pain. So German steel production down 12%, 2 million fewer cars made than in 2017. Green levies, gas rationing, U.S. tariffs slap Germany while Berlin stays muzzled, and this is the output of that. These are job losses over here. A whopping 245,000 jobs shed in Germany. So that's eight quarters job growth. Well, it's seen job growth only 8 quarters out of 22. So they're just flagging. But this was the astonishing graphic in that Financial Times. So says here, the staggering Financial Times infographic shows the utter collapse of Volkswagen, the crown jewel of the German auto industry, one of the most important sectors in the German economy. And these are all job losses. They're just hemorrhaging jobs like crazy because they shot themselves in their energy foot.
Yeah. And I don't understand how leaders that love their country, that love their neighbor, can put a country in a situation like that. It's their responsibility to be looking out where we're where they need to be and leading to compete from a long-term standpoint. So they're either that foolish, or they're corrupted by some entity that's trying to bring a country down. I mean, there's nothing else that makes sense to me that you would lead your country into a circumstance like that. And the media has controlled the propaganda that's been cast upon the people, where the people have become convinced that this is the right way to go because they don't actually take the time to critically think about what they're being told or look at the data behind it. I mean, the data you're showing is clear. That's national suicide.
It is, and for a manufacturing center like Germany, energy's the beating heart of that story, and it's just obvious, right? So what's the definition of an insanity, like trying the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result? Mm-hmm. They're going to throw that $500 billion at more green energy.
Yeah.
Which already doesn't work.
No. And I would venture to say they already have their grift in the pipeline. So they're going to throw the money at that so they can grift some of that money out for their own benefit and for their own individuals at the expense of the people that they're supposed to love.
So you mentioned, you know, what's the dark force? It's socialism. It's communism. It feels like that, right? Which always has the same story over and over again. If we just do a little more of the same utopia, we'll get to this green energy utopia. And it doesn't work, but you said the important part, Paul, because every time I look at it, I see you peel it back a little bit, and it's just grifting and grafting. The people at the top just sort of siphoning money out of this whole thing and getting stupid rich, while the whole rest of their fellow countrymen suffer. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mm-hmm. seem to bother them for some reason.
It doesn't seem to at all. I'll tell you one thing that's fascinating. Nearly everything that I watch and listen to, I think back to the markets, because that's what I love. That's what I do for a living. So I've had a blast, you know, with Will playing at Georgia Tech and listening to Coach Key just talk about the importance. You know, they rank 7-0 for the first time since 1966. They're 7-0 for the first time in quite some time. It's been really fun. I mean, I love the parents and those young men that are out there battling. Of course, Will's a part of it, so I am fully hooked. But, you know, listen to his press conferences. He points out it's a privilege to be in a position of this. It's a privilege. Enjoy it. But understand mid-season, you either get better or you become complacent. So he's trying to keep these young men constantly focused on improve in every way you can. Well, let's bring that back to what we're hearing coming out of China. I think we've talked about this for the past couple of weeks. They have developed their manufacturing process in an unbelievable way. They're taking artificial intelligence, and instead of trying to achieve the AGI, artificial general intelligence, they're focusing on application. So we're hearing rumors and discussions and reports that venture capital has determined several sectors of manufacturing to be uninvestable. Now, this comes back to Germany. That's where I'm going. So you got China here recently, and let me pull up the data. It was, what's the gentleman's name? Give me just a second. So, well, I want to make sure I give him the hit. I made notes, but I didn't make it quick enough. Fine. So Alex Kamani of oilprice.com was talking about what has occurred. So about a year ago, China's battery manufacturing capacity, because they had put tremendous amount of investment in there, was only producing at 30% of its capacity. So they had this massive overcapacity. Well, what it led to was lower prices. You know, manufacturing capacity, ultimately supply and demand leads to deflation within that, and technologies and efficiency. So after the consolidation of some of the smaller manufacturers that couldn't compete, they decided, hey, we've got to open up some of these foreign markets. Well, let's see here. China Energy Storage Alliance has reported a more than 220% year-over-year increase in overseas markets where they decided to go. Now, in spite of the tariffs reducing demand within the United States, about 3% of that came from the United States, with nearly 60% coming from the Middle East, Europe, and Australia. Now, my point is, you've got a country that is focused on where they're going, trying to be excellent and pursuing every single day. And now they've got this manufacturing capacity versus what Germany's been known for as a manufacturing powerhouse, that they're just letting it die. They're not going to turn that around overnight. And you know, college football is a lot more competitive now, but we've seen tons of programs in the past that gave up on pursuing that excellence and believe that they should be winning just because they're a brand name. And then all of a sudden they fall out of the top 25 and their fans have to go through. It's not going to be any different in Germany. And it also brings me back to this hype that we have and belief in the United States. Yes, we can compete in manufacturing. Yes, we can do it quicker than probably the rest of the world if we get the regulation out of the way, because the ingenuity of some percentages of the population in the United States that want to go there, but it's going to take time. I mean, they have such a lead on us and Germany and everybody else. It may be generations before Germany gets back to being the manufacturing powerhouse they're in, because they're going to have to experience enough pain to where that pain, you know, when the pain is severe enough, people will change. And they obviously don't seem to be heading in that direction. Let's just throw money at it. Money we don't have. Let's go borrow it, because people are stupid enough to give it to us. And then you've got China that's going to continue to separate themselves from them in the future. This is going to be devastating for the German people long term and Europe.
Well, absolutely. And if you lose something, like let's say you lose your steel manufacturing. Well, I'll tell you a personal example. I got this handwritten letter, kind of shaky, kind of older man sort of like stuff. And he said, hey, I'm writing to you because I loved your crash course, but I'm here at this factory where we're boxing up the last tool and die for making locomotives. We're out of the game. Like, we don't make them anymore. And he went on to explain, he's like, and by the way, if next year, even, this was 10 years ago, so this is even worse. He said, if next year we said, that was a mistake, let's get those things back over here. He said, you'll have all these gray hairs retired. And he's like, you know, you don't just suddenly wake up and go onto monster.com and find somebody who knows how to cast a 12-ton engine block, right? Or, you know, whatever all those components are. He said, once you lose that, you have all these journeymen. There's a whole system of training and apprenticeship and mastery that goes into any particular high-end thing. Even something as simple as you might, you know, just making glass, right? You're like, well, how hard could that be? You melt sand and you pour it out, right? No, it takes, like, there's a whole mastery to anything.
Yes.
And once you lose it, like you said, it could take generations to get that back because that's what it takes.
And one thing I learned in competing, when I got into shooting sporting clays, I sought out a level 3 NSCA instructor because I knew that the knowledge that they could pass down to me, could I learn it if I have enough time and figure out the efficiency? Yes, because I had to do it in the water skiing side. But I shortened my learning curve by a decade, really, by hiring somebody that was experienced that could disciple me. Well, when there's no disciples there, you have to learn it from scratch again. And do you really think that you're going to be able to go to your competitor, which in that industry is an enemy, and say, hey, will you disciple me? No, you're going to have to learn that over. So you're right.
You know what? Gold and silver are my top choices to protect my wealth against inflation and economic instability. Now, with all the monetary debasement and all these geopolitical risks going on, hedging your wealth has never been more important. I recommend that everybody own some gold and silver, physical, in your hot little hands. But what if you want to hold it elsewhere? Goldcorp is an excellent choice and will rapidly and securely deliver physical gold and silver to your doorstep. But Goldcorp also lets you buy and store your gold and silver in high security vaults in places like Switzerland or Singapore or the US at your choice. And for all of my followers, Goldcorp will provide your first 6 months of storage for free. With Goldcorp, you get the convenience of buying and selling precious metals as easily as stocks, but with the security of your metals being fully allocated and segregated, meaning they sit in a secure location on a shelf in a box with your name and your name only on it. Now, unlike your stocks, where you are actually a subordinated security entitlement claimant, something we learned during our Great Taking series, you are the one and only named owner of your metals. But just like stocks, you can still sell your metals instantly at market prices without any unnecessary delays. Need liquidity? Goldcorp gives you immediate access to cash. But if you prefer physical delivery, getting them shipped to you is a mouse click away. Goldcorp offers a range of investment options from gold and silver coins and bars to self-directed IRAs, again, all with fully segregated and secure storage. Take control of your financial future today with Goldcorp, where investing in precious metals has never been easier, more secure, or more transparent. Remember, Peak Prosperity followers get 6 months of free storage. So sign up now at peak.fan/goldcore to secure your 6 months of free storage. Again, that's peak.fan/goldcore. You know what Europe's going to do about all this? They're going to be Europe about this, and they're going to try and technocrat their way through it. And so I caught this article by Martin Armstrong yesterday. If people don't know him, you can check him out at armstrongeconomics.com. And he wrote here, quote, the European Union is planning to cancel paper currency and move to CBDCs, as we've discussed before, Paul, to carry out one. Claiming they wish to eliminate the American credit card system of Visa and MasterCard, they claim for economic independence when in truth, the European monetary system is already collapsing. Two, they are seriously claiming national security, insisting that Putin wants to invade Europe when there's nothing there of an independent monetary value to justify such an invasion. They have no energy, no gold or rare earths. It's a Marxist utopia that's imploding, just as communism did in Russia and China. Like, why would Putin want to, like, take over an imploding system? Nobody would. Who wants to step into that mess, he writes? It will collapse all by itself. No, the EU wants to claim the threat of Russian invasion to justify their confiscation of private accounts to fund their war with Russia, and three, to prevent capital flight from the EU, trapping all capital for their use. That's what the CBDCs are about. It's about trapping capital. And he closed with this. If you do not move your money out of Europe before 2026, you may find yourself trapped, unable to even buy gold.
Wow. That's a heck of a statement. That's a major warning from somebody who does their research.
Yep. And that's why at the beginning I said, hey, little cautionary tale coming out of Europe. Canada, I think it has the same instincts, right? Mm-hmm. Probably Australia, same instincts. Mm-hmm. We'll get here too eventually if it gets bad enough, because it's all kind of the same. We're all under the same sort of, regime, which is that the leaders can't, Paul, they can't look us in the eye and say, you know, we got ourselves into a real pickle here. And to get out of it, we're going to have to live below our means for a while because we just borrowed, we just overdid it with our financial system, right? We just overdid it. We just made promises we can't keep. We spent money on dumb things like blowing up bridges in other countries, which don't really add to our economy. So we're going to have to do some hard things now. And here's why. And you're going to have to tighten your belts and da, 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 right? Nobody's willing to do that politically.
No, they're not. And even down to a local level, they're just not willing to do it because of a couple of things. One, they have to admit they were wrong in their leadership. That hurts their pride. Mm-hmm. People are more concerned about what other people think of them than they are the truth in our society today. There's no fear of God, right? That if I lie to you, then I'm going to suffer the consequences of that at some point in the future. There is a righteous individual that will judge me, and they're just not going to do it. And that reminds me of something. Even back in 2000, so after the 2008 crisis, I got asked to come talk to the board because this church was in financial trouble. Mm-hmm. So I show up and I sit down and, you know, have a conversation with them. I said, guys, first there has to be confession before there's the healing on the other side. God says that if you're faithful to confess your sins, you know, he'll heal us from that. Doesn't mean it removes the consequences completely. This is me, Chris. This is just me thinking. So anybody that's talked to me, I will say exactly what I think. And so they were like, so what should we do? And I said, the first thing that I believe that you should do is get, you know, have a church meeting on Sunday, get in front of the body of the church, because each member is responsible for the loan that's out here, and confess that you've erred, you've missed the mark, and you're in a situation to where you have too much debt. There were a couple of heads that, you know, shook and a couple that didn't. And then I said, rely upon the people out there. Let's let the church get down on our hands and knees and pray and ask the Lord to help get us out of this after we confess that we've erred. Mm-hmm. Well, conversation kind of went good from there. We shared some ideas. And the first thing the next morning, I got called in for a meeting and says, you know, you don't need to be pushing your ideas on us anymore. We no longer need your opinions. And I said, you asked me to come in. Right. And they said, it doesn't matter how you ended up there. We don't want that conversation going out to anybody else or us. We've got this taken care of. So even on the local level, in an institution that should be willing to get down like that, if the church is unwilling to do it, how can you expect the governments to do it? Because they're not having any fear of God in any way whatsoever. So it's going to be forced upon them at some point is what's going to happen.
Well, and then to evade that, CBDCs, right? So the equivalent would be, you know, if to translate between that church experience and the EU, the church is basically saying, oh, Paul, we have a very clever plan to trap people into that debt.
Yeah.
And make sure that they have no way to escape it. And it'll all work out, right? Mm-hmm. When, in fact, you know, as John Stuart Mill said a long time ago, he's a famous economist, 1800s, he said, panics do not destroy capital. They merely expose the extent to which it has already been hopelessly betrayed.
That's really good. That's a really good statement. That's very true.
It's already gone, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh no, we got to prevent this thing from happening. It already happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the message. That's the message gold and silver have been sending us. But I think we'll see it across all commodities eventually because, you know, All that capital that's out there is really just promises, and everybody's playing this game in musical chairs, and we're all happy to continue swapping, you know, currency units with each other. But at some point, there's that moment where people go, I'd rather have real stuff, you know?
That's right. And they quit pushing paper and go into the physical, and that's when the game is over.
Right. Right. And maybe we see that happen in December. We'll see. In the time we have left, Paul, I want to just quick talk about our favorite private equity. So you want to know how I know the private equity game is over? It's like done.
Mm-hmm.
Because German banks are trying to push private equity funds to their own retail investors.
It's not funny. It's really sad, but there's nothing you can do except for laugh when you've been warning people that this is coming and now it's actually unfolding.
Well, so I'll tell you, one of my favorite stories ever, what was written by Michael Lewis, he was writing about the whole subprime disaster that happened in the great financial crisis. And he asked the question, like, why did Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank, big German banks, why did they get, like, this happens to them over and over again. They end up with this dog meat, like, debt that Wall Street sells them. And he goes through this long explanation and says that the German people are so ingrained with values around, like, that laws are important. They it doesn't occur to them that Goldman Sachs just lies to them repeatedly. It just doesn't land. So they're like the last willing customer for some of the doggiest dog meat out there. And then, but by the time the German banks have figured out that private equity needs to be pushed off their books onto somebody else, they don't always ring a bell at the top, Paul, but this is a clanging church bell to me right here.
Oh, that's a clanging church bell. And look, the past performance returns at this point, because they're publishing them like crazy. You know, I mean, Harvard even, who has some issues with the private equity in their endowment, are like, had you just allocated this amount to private equity in your portfolio like the rich people do, then you would have had these returns at this point. Well, yeah, had you have actually had capital available and bought the bottom of the S&P in 2009, you wouldn't have had this return too. So they're presenting this to investors who don't know how to gauge they really don't know how to analyze an investment. So, or the strengths and risks of a strategy. So they're like, what would it have done? Oh, if I'd have just done that, and they project that into the future, without taking the time to realize this is a completely different environment than it was when private equity started and they had a $5 million minimum before you could get in, and then it drops to a $2 million minimum and then a $1 million minimum. And now all of a sudden they want to offload their shares on everybody else. The classic Wall Street grift in time. Let's shut the gate so you can't come in. We'll let our performance be really, really good. And as soon as that performance is great, we're going to create a market so we can dump it off on the average individual and just continue to keep our boot on their neck. Pisses me off. Sorry.
Yeah, me too. Me too. But you're a financial pro, so you'll get this. So I just came across this morning. Trigger warning from Junk Bond Investor. Private asset marketing material. Says, private assets have been considerably less volatile than public assets. Look at private equity with an annual volatility of just 9.5%, stupid low. Like private debt, 7.7%. So the reason you're going to love this is Lawrence McDonald said, hey, I just sat down with a forensic accountant GOAT, the greatest of all time, last weekend, Harry Markopoulos. The foundational clue of all clues in outing Madoff, Bernie Madoff, the Ponzi schemer of the day. Extremely low volatility. That's the foundational clue. Low volatility.
Bingo.
Three standard deviations relative to every other style of asset management. That's private equity, private debt. It's just super low, Paul. It's been amazing returns, low volatility. Harry Markopoulos would like us to know that's something you run from as fast as possible.
Yes. And look, housing has less volatility than what stocks do because they're harder to get out of. You know, by the time you have this emotional panic, it's 3 months later before somebody may be making an offer on a house in a normal market, and if it's priced right. So private equity did not have liquidity in the past. Of course it's going to have lower volatility than anything else, especially when it's private and outside of some of the regulations where you don't have to mark to market as regular. But, that's just that nice shiny bait, to pull retail in so they can find their exit.
Hey, Paul, we just want to share some amazing high return, low risk assets with you.
With you. And when you blow up again and things turn down the other way and we have temporary deflation, guess what? We're going to buy everything back from you for pennies on the dollar, and your family's going to be wiped out. So, you know, I mean,
nothing personal,
you know, just business, right? Just business. Yeah. There's a morality to everything that we should do. We have a responsibility to be moral.
Sorry, hate the game, not the player.
Right.
Yeah, all that. Hey, I have this idea that I got from one of the greatest traders I ever worked with back in the day. And he said that when you're looking for when markets are going to crack, you look from the outside in. Meaning, if you're looking at bonds, you don't look at treasuries, which are the center of the whole thing. You look at the edge, junk debt, you know, the junkies to the junk, right? You know, when, mm-hmm. when economic downturns happen, they tend to happen from the outside in, right? When people, mm-hmm. are, you know, recessions hurt people from the bottom up, right? So the outside mm-hmm. in is this concept that you look at the edges. And so, oops, we have another one that just went down this morning, subprime lender PrimaLend. This PrimaLend provides financing to auto dealerships that cater to subprime borrowers. That's the outside mm-hmm. of this story, not the prime borrowers, but subprime. Mm-hmm. And if only somebody could have seen this coming, Paul, this was bizarre to me. 30% of loans-ish are underwater when they get trade-in, so negative equity. So people are buying cars, coming to trade that car back in, and are still underwater. So what do you have to do? Well, I guess you have to take the underwater portion and wrap it on top of the new car or lease that you're making. It's just crazy to me. How I didn't grow up this way. It would have never occurred to me that I would owe more on a car than it's worth at the time that I'm getting a new car.
Mm-hmm. No, me either. Neither. But look, there's a whole subset out there of individuals that are fighting so hard to get by, and they just want to have a nice car. It makes them feel better about themselves. And then you have these predatory lenders that come in that are using somebody else's capital, mom and pop's capital. Well, Wall Street's, they want to unload on mom and pop. And then they just keep that going, you know, for arbitrage in the interim period until it blows up. And blow up at will. I mean, I didn't see that this morning, but I did see. So let me go back down here to, you know, we had Tricolor Auto Parts Supplier, First Brands. And of course, Jamie Dimon comes out and says, we're one cockroach, there's another. But this week, we also had Regional Bank Zions and Western Alliance disclose they were victims of loan fraud tied to funds yep. investing in distressed commercial real estate. And then back to auto loans. Vantage Score, which keeps up with some of the private equity products tied to the riskiest consumer, has seen a 50% surge in delinquencies lately. So this is just getting started. And what's going to change it right now? What's going to stop that? The lower subset is hurting bad. I mean, they are hurting bad. And it's just those at the top that are keeping things going right now. But at some point, this is going to trickle, work its way up to the top, like you said, from the outside in.
Well, if we had lower electricity bills, oh no, that's probably not in the cards.
No.
Food what hasn't really gotten. Oh, insurance. Maybe insurance costs will go to. Oh.
Oh. Have no, you? They haven't either.
Oh no. I'm actually bracing for impact because I still carry a private plan, you know, through the ACA stuff because I'm, you know, work for myself, all that, but. I've been hearing reports that people have saying they're getting doublings and triplings of their insurance bills for health insurance, like really nasty increases. And again, nobody can quite explain why. Where are the regulators? Did it really cost? Does hospitals go up 3x or whatever the story is? No, they're just, they made some other bets that went bad and now they're trying to make up for that. Right. So, speaking of which, I just heard a very uncomfortable, earnings call. I think it was with one of the Western regional banks where the analyst had said, what are you carrying these commercial properties on your books at?
Oh.
And they were carrying them at basically 100 cents on the dollar. And the question was, are you aware that fair market price, these things are going off 10, 20 cents on the dollar? So mm-hmm. where's that in the allowance for doubtful accounts part of your, you know, reporting statement? And they're not wrapped in yet.
So nothing marked to market from that standpoint. They're
not yet.
Oh my goodness. There's still a lot of losses on banks across the board, and regional banks have been pummeled in the past week or so. And that's another outside in sign that there's a lot of troubles under the surface.
So with all that, I mean, it's just, you know, obviously there's huge things afoot, geopolitically, you know, there's way too many, I think, just this morning, I read that Trump canceled the meeting in Budapest with Putin. So no need to discuss Ukraine because we're just too far apart on that. So that carries on. You know, there's obviously conflicts between Pakistan and Afghanistan and on and on and on. So with all that said, I still don't understand how it is that the equity markets have priced in exactly nothing but perfection. going forward.
Well, it's just the euphoric part of the cycle. Investors are not worried about reality. They're not worried about fundamentals because fundamentals haven't rewarded them substantially here recently. Mm-hmm. You've got brokers that are out there, and I'm really having a good time talking to the general Wall Street broker right now that'll take the time to talk to me. They are euphoric. Like, they've taken the most recent past and projected it into the future. And I guess it was, you know, over the past couple of years, you've mentioned creak and popping. There's been all kinds of creaks and popping, but we're hearing snaps and pops at this point. Snaps, well, creaking and popping with snaps, with mm-hmm. rumblings of the earthquakes under the surface. These failures and these frauds that we're finding, those are many earthquakes that are occurring in the credit system. And hey, do we get the big one? Or do we have more time? I don't know. But I can tell you the risk right now is dramatically higher than the average individual has any clue of and any clue whatsoever. And we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. So I'm not saying that we're batting down the hatches and have completely head for cover, but our fingers on the trigger at this point, because it won't take a whole lot more information to really realize for the average person that the game is up. It's going to, you know, it's just going to take some time.
It is. I got to see if I can pull this up really quickly.
I'm just going to share margin debt right now. Cabisi later put this out. And margin debt skyrocketing. September 2025, U.S. investors took out another $67 billion in margin debt, bringing the total to a record $1.13 trillion. Meanwhile, 5x leverage ETFs have just been proposed by the SEC. I mean, we're at that part of the cycle. I mean, look at where margin debt is right now. It's grown dramatically. It spiked right before 2007. It spiked right before 2000. Spiked right in late 2018. Of course, COVID crash and all the money that was printed, it spiked right before, right in October 21, right before major corrections, we've seen this huge spike. And this is just that euphoria and belief that it's different this time, whether people realize that's the case or not. And it just shows how tedious, with all of these other things starting to come apart, this narrative behind the markets are. And I mean, there's a lot of good things taking place economically, potentially from a long-term standpoint, but it's not going to arrive as fast as what people expect it is. And this is just another sign that this is a very dangerous situation we find ourselves in.
Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. Right here, the debasement trade is why gold and silver have been going up. But this is $10 trillion of new U.S. debt in 5 years. So $2 trillion a year. Spoiler alert, as I wrote on Peak Financial Investing, the Twitter account for this channel, we're going to have that over the next 5 years too. I mean, just trillions and trillions are going in. So we're going to be printing like crazy. Europe is going to have to print like crazy because, we need $500 billion to bail out our bad decisions just in Germany alone, et cetera. And then Japan, what I was trying to find, but I couldn't pull it up quick. So this is from memory, but it looks like their 2-year debt is about to cross over the 2% zone. And I've heard it said over and over again that that's the line of death, meaning that once their interest rates rise high enough, they have to print money just to pay the interest, which causes the interest rates to go up. So they're going to have to print more. That's the final spiral. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to have to fight that really hard. But here's the basic story. everybody in the West, that includes Japan in this story, they're just going to have to print. It's either print or let it all sort of collapse into this austerity thing that everybody's going to hate. Nobody ever chooses that. It could happen, but it would be an accident if it did. Instead, they're going to print and print and print and do everything they can to just throttle the canary, you know, which is gold.
Right. And that's all they know how to do. That's the only thing that they're experienced at. They're not experienced in any other path. And I would say it's with great terror that they would, the path less traveled is just terrifying to them. That's all they know how to do. Mm-hmm. And they're going to keep doing it until they can't do it anymore.
And what does that look like, do you think? I don't even know. I can't even imagine. But it'll be chaotic and, you know, it'll be... Listen, sometimes over your head you have history of bubbles like today, but other times, you know, you have to have a plan, you know? And I think that that's really when it becomes... If they lose control of this beach ball or whatever the metaphor is, it's going to be really hard for most people to operate because it's going to be paralyzing, right? We'll all have tunnel vision. We won't know what's happening. We won't have the context to understand why any of it's happening. We won't have a sense of where that puck is going. So there'll be a lot of panicky decisions made at that point in time. And I get it, right? But when the dust settles, we find out that we had 50 years of excesses that got sort of like sorted out in a few years. And that's going to land in a bad way for a lot of people, I fear. Maybe I'm wrong.
I fear too. Yeah. And it's going to ultimately happen. The question is when. How much longer can they keep this game going? There are forces that are, there are events that can occur that can cause this to last a little bit longer than anybody thinks is possible. But at the same time, it's going to happen slowly, which it has been happening, and then all at once.
Yep.
So, you know, what can you do? This is one thing I encourage investors to do, and we've talked about this before. You have to consider all of the potential paths on the way this can unfold. And think about that. Even the scary paths. And the reason is, if you've thought about it and at least you've had some conversation, then subconsciously you're ready to move quicker than what the average person is. So you may be scared, you may be terrified, but you're not panicking. You've at least had some consideration as to what could take place. And I learned that years ago when I was doing scenario training with weapons training. It's like, what do you do if somebody comes up and they're ready to rob you? You know, you have to think through this so you're not frozen. You're not going to move perfectly necessarily, but you can't panic in the moment. So, you know, the clients that we serve, we do that for them, whether they're doing it or not, and try to communicate and plant seeds to say, hey, if this happens, this is the path that we need to go down. But what I'm finding right now in a lot of the conversations I'm having is a lot of your average investors that have been passive, they're admitting this is unsustainable. I don't understand this in any way whatsoever. This seems too good to be true. And people, you know, I had a conversation with somebody I was telling you about before we started and said, I need you to tell me what to do. And I said, well, I can't tell you what to do, right? You know, what are you more concerned if this runs for two more years of missing some opportunity? And this is somebody that's in their 80s with 90% equity, okay? Are you more concerned about missing some potential opportunity over the next 12 months, or are you more concerned about losing 50% of your capital? And then all of a sudden, it was like some, you know, glaze goes across their eyes. And they said, well, you know, in my lifetime, it's always recovered quickly. The government's able to do a few things to get it back quickly. And I said, well, what about the Great Depression? They weren't able to do anything then. It was 25 years later before it came back. And you know, and of course, a seed of truth hits and they go, well, I don't have 25 years for it to come back, but I'll just leave it to my kids. It'll come back for them. And, you know, and that's fine. I understand that. At least I took them through that conversation. But for investors out there, if you've been fortunate enough to stay passive all the way up till now, then good for you. You've been very lucky. You've been very fortunate. You have squeezed all of the strengths of a passive strategy out, and we're at all-time high valuations for the market, meaning the market is ridiculously expensive, and the economic outcome has to be ever more perfect. That's why they talk about Goldilocks, ever more perfect, and really break all historical records at this point to keep this train going with nothing going wrong. Okay, and anybody who's owned a car for long enough, there's always something that breaks that needs to be repaired. So you know, at least consider, are you willing to endure a 50% decline? Are you willing to endure stocks underperforming commodities and other assets for a 15 or 20 year period of time if this changes? Or if we had another depressionary type event, you know, are you comfortable with it going sideways for 25 years? Was that going to wreck your retirement? At least consider that if you want to continue that path. And if the answer of those, if the answer to any of those questions causes you to consider, hey, maybe that's not where I want to be, then think about taking a different path where it's not about beating the S&P 500 for this point. It's about protecting my capital, being prudent and wise, and I'm willing to separate from the herd and what the media is telling me to do right now, which tends to be more for Wall Street's benefit than yours, and walk a path less traveled and be where other people are going to want to come back to be when this thing ends. And, you know, because, and I have a lot of questions with people. They'll say they don't know what to ask. They'll ask about performance. And I had somebody not too long ago say, well, can you promise me that you're going to beat what we could do ourselves or the S&P? And I said, no, nobody can promise you that. And if they're willing to promise you that, you need to run. But the reality is, let's get back to the conversation of risk reward right now. Are you comfortable if it doesn't come out Goldilocks scenario? Are you comfortable with what that'll do to the resources that, you know, the assets that you spent your life sacrificing to set to the side? Are you comfortable that they could potentially decline by 50 to 60% if it's not different this time? Or your S&P goes sideways because we have a near hyperinflationary event and commodities go up dramatically and your cost of living, you know, your purchasing power reduces dramatically. We're not going to get out of this without some pain. And we can't keep doing the same things when you've reached the maximum strength for a particular strategy and expect the same outcome for the next 10 years. That's why I believe a risk-managed, adaptive, tactical strategy, and get away from trying to beat the S&P 500 in the short run. It's going to happen from time to time, but that's not your objective. Your objective is to manage your money prudently and wisely. And I still believe that right now, the return of your capital or the maintaining of your purchasing power is more important than the return on your capital right now.
I would agree. And, you know, we've been nipping around the edges of this. Maybe we should do a whole episode on this idea, which is that, you have to know where you are in the larger cycle, right? You've got your fourth turning cycles, you've got industrial revolutions, you've got, there's these big cycles that sort of come to things. And, you know, Ecclesiastes, right? For every thing, there is a season, right?
Yes, yes.
You know, and yes. I feel like what our Federal Reserve has attempted to do is like have us in a seasonless environment. Like, no, we can prevent seasons from happening. It's like, no, you can't. All you can do is have misallocations of capital pile up in larger, ugly areas, you know, all over this whole thing. And it's just unnatural. Like, that's my main complaint about the Federal Reserve. They're trying to do something I consider unnatural. You should Yes. allow things to breathe in, breathe out. You know, you have expansionary periods, you have contractionary periods. And in the contractions, though, they're good. There's nothing wrong with them, you know? They're good. You clear out the deadwood, you know? You get rid of the bad companies, right? You give Mm-hmm. opportunities for new vital companies to arise. You leave space for the next generation to step in and do something. It's not what they've done. It's totally unnatural.
Correct.
As far as I'm concerned.
It is. Well, in one of the conversations I was having with my son the other day, I said, look, you have to build your reputation now, be known for somebody that's honest, you're young, and then you'll be able to command more price down the road, because people in today's society care more about somebody who will communicate honestly and clearly with them, because they're getting everybody in the world telling them what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. So, but by the Federal Reserve stepping in, it's propped up businesses, which lowers profitability, which means we have to work, you know, eight times as hard to maintain where you are. Whereas if a free market was involved in these cycles and the deadwood was gone and these companies that have, you know, they're living on credit and leverage only are cleared out of the way, quality of life increases on the other side of that too, and the quality of products that we're getting and the quality of service that we're able to get. So they're punishing more than just our monetary system. They're punishing the quality of our life by trying to artificially control everything, because they believe, as central planners, which is a communist, you know, term anyway, isn't it? Central planners, that they know what's best for the free market.
Well, and it just speaks, Paul, to the power of having a bad idea, a bad narrative, right? So we talked about Germany. Germany had a bad narrative installed, which was like, oh, we need to get rid of our coal-fired plants, our nuclear plants, and we're just going to throw down on wind and solar. And you would think in a normal environment, after a few years, you'd go, okay, wind and solar have a place, but it's not a central, it's sort of a niche thing, which is cool. We'll use it to sort of fill in, but we need to support our way of life, our industrial base, with cheap, reliable energy. So let's solve that first, then we'll do some stuff on the edges and see if it works. No, they went all in, dismantled all of their nuclear plants, took them down. The cheapest, most reliable baseload power. It's bizarre. So that's a bad idea, right? I think the Federal Reserve is pursuing a similarly bad narrative, which is, oh, it's important for us to control the outcome of markets because that leads to the greatest something. In fact, we've shown the charts before. All it leads to is a wealth gap because you financialize everything. And the top 0.1%, and I mean that literally, 0.1% does the best. The next 0.9% does good, but not as good. And everybody under that just does worse and worse and worse. Yes. That's a communist philosophy.
Yes, it is. And you led right to the heart of the matter. We can look back and see how the wealth gap has continued to separate from the average person, and the middle class has been eviscerated. While these individuals are surrounded by the top 0.1% that's in their ear all the time for their own benefit because they have no care for the American people. It's all about them, their greed, and enough will never be enough.
But beware, because eventually, you know what they do? Eventually, you end up here. know where you are in the cycle. When German banks are pushing something on you, run, Forrest, run. Yes. Not investment advice, just an idea, okay? All right. All right, Paul. Well, thanks so much for your time today. And for anybody who wants to speak with Paul and his amazing team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a very simple form, and somebody from Paul's team will be in contact with you within 48 business hours to set up your first appointment. And by the way, when you talk with Paul and his team, you will get a complete financial review and a total understanding of your particular circumstances. So it's a very valuable process for everybody who's gone through it. Whether or not you end up working with Paul and his team is a side question after that. So I'd highly advise everybody take a peek and see what a good financial review, I mean a comprehensive one, will actually do for your understanding of where you really actually stand, which is, again, Paul, to your point, you tell people the truth and what needs to be told, not what you think they want to hear, which is super important.
And it's our responsibility to let people know the reality of their situation and then help them work through the options of the decisions that fit their circumstances the best. So that's what we live for. That's what we're honored to do. I love the asset management and the tactical side, but the foundation of everything that we do for people is that financial plan analysis, the retirement plan analysis. And that just gives so much peace to people, whether they work with us or not. And that's worth every bit of the effort that me, John, Dylan, and now Alex put into it.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you for that. And thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of Finance U. We'll be back with you next week with, I'm sure, something amazing again. All right. Thanks, everybody.